You're listening to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Today's episode is based on my 1991 interview with NBA Hall of Famer Wilt Chamberlain. At 7'1", he's one of the most successful athletes to ever come out of the Philadelphia area. But as great as Wilt was in his prime playing days in the 1960s, many fans across the country saw him as a villain. He dominated the league, but also came up short many times against the then juggernaut Boston Celtics. Our conversation starts there, with Wilt, at age 55, reflecting on how feeling like the villain affected him personally.
People have a hard time relating to villains, but when you are my physical size, over 7 foot, sometimes over 300 pounds, a man of color, it's not easy for people to relate. But the problem here is people believing that because of size, you don't have a sensitivity. You have no real feeling for a lot of things that they take for granted in people of lesser stature physically. And that's just all wrong. And it's time for that, you know, that view to change.
You talk about being the villain or being seen as the villain on the court. You chose the number 13, right? I mean, isn't this what a villain does?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I have to admit that I sometimes reveled in being the villain. In fact, I used to kind of giggle at myself when I was announced in the Boston Gardens. They would say, Wilt Chamberlain, number 13, and the boos would come ringing from the stands, and I would laugh. I said, yeah, number 13 on the scoreboard, but number one in your hearts, even the hate.
Well, do you think by having that number 13 on your back, you were really sending a message to your opponents? Because I know that there's a lot of superstition that goes on in sports.
Yeah, you know, it is, and I always thought that 13 was a bad luck number. And I said, yeah, but for them, not for me.
They have to look at it,
right?
Would you say there's something even about the kind of coverage that you've gotten, even about the sports writers, the sports writing? They don't always get it right, but do you think people got it right with you?
Well, I think they get it wrong a whole lot of times, and I think the sports writers, you know, are human. They make mistakes. It depends on what side of the bed they get up on. They have to sometimes always have someone that's going to make their stories interesting. You know, like a motion picture. You got to have the good guy and the bad guy. Well, when these guys are writing, you know, they want to have a good guy and a bad guy. And for many of these writers, I was the bad guy.
And you don't think they appreciated your talents?
No, they did. So they had to allude, though, to, you know, things maybe that I wasn't doing. They want to, you know, if you just say, hey, he really is good, he does this, he does that, you know, it's not enough. So they had to find some things that maybe they thought I was, like, not so good on. And the only thing they could really come up with was, like, not winning at all. You know, and there was a team out there where I was playing that was winning it all, the Boston Celtics, Bill Russell.
Well, we'll get to Bill Russell.
Right.
your nemesis.
My nemesis. Yeah.
Well, let's get to the fact that I think you're causing a lot of people to do some long division here in the country. And part of your book has to do with the fact that you say that you've had 20,000 sexual encounters over a period of 40 years. And as I say, everyone's doing their long division. Why did you want to go public with that?
I don't like the word had. I like the word being involved, first of all. And I want to go public with that because I'm writing a book that's public about my life. I'm writing a book about the views that shaped my life. If I said to you that I was a basketball player and I was a good scorer, what does good really mean? If I told you, though, I scored 100 points in one game and averaged 50 points in one season, you get an idea. So as a writer, I was trying to relate to some of the things I did off of the court. How can you leave out your sexual activities, your encounters, which consume such a great deal of your life, and be honest about what you're now about to write? So I said, I didn't want to get too personal, but I wanted these readers to understand that I was involved, and especially in the 60s and 70s, where there was a sexual revolution among women. They wanted to equate a lot more with men, and they wanted to have a chance to do some of the things that men have been doing for years. I was much younger, strong, healthy, able, and willing, you understand? And so I was prolific in that particular area. But I want people to understand that this is the 90s. You have some sexual diseases out there that really are incredibly bad. The book was not to promote promiscuity. I believe in safe sex, and I'm not trying to send a message to younger people or what have you. And so I want to get that straight. But what I did, I'm not embarrassed about, you understand? And, you know, for me, even though it was so many women, it may have been a short time with a lot of them, but it was a quality time and a respectful time. And you can have that in a short time. You don't have to have a long relationship.
Well, I wonder, because part of your book, you want to talk about racism. There are other things that you want to talk about, how the game of basketball has changed by including a revelation. And I think, you know, there are not too many people that can say that they've had 20,000 sexual encounters, that it kind of skews the conversation. Mm. I don't want to spend a lot of time here because there's so much more to you that I do want to talk about. But this is what is kind of caught people. You know how Americans
think. Sure. In fact, I have it in my book that America is run by sex. Sex rules the world. So I shouldn't have been so naive as to think that maybe just one of those two little sentences was not going to get and then it did. And I'm not sorry for it, because it's helping me to bring some attention to my book. And I know that when they pick the book up, if they read it, they will see all the other things. So thank God for that. You understand? But it is not the crux of my book, but it is part of my life. Mm-hmm. And this is about my life and what has shaped the views.
But you say this is no longer a part of your life.
Not in the way it was before, not at all.
And that is because, literally because of AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases?
I'm afraid it is. I'm still very much motivated by lust, you know, and by beautiful ladies inside and outside. But unfortunately, this is a time that one has to act differently.
And I'm told, or actually you write, that you're as likely to curl up in bed with a book.
I am more likely. You know, I mean, I know it sounds a little strange, but you're right. My friends, when I say that to them, they kind of look at me, well, it's okay. But no, I like, you know, National Geographic, the Smithsonian books of epic nature. I like to read about history and what have you. And I love it. So if they want to think I'm curling up with something else, let them.
Okay. Wilt Chamberlain is my guest today on Radio Times. Of course, a legendary basketball player, and was born in Philadelphia, attended Overbrook High School, played for the Philadelphia teams, also San Francisco, Los Angeles, and the Harlem Globetrotters. He's just written a book. It's called A View from Above. Let's talk about Bill Russell.
Okay.
Is he still your nemesis?
No, not at all. And as I reflect on, you know, our encounters, first of all, I must say I was fortunate to come into the league and have him to be a competitor. Because I only believe that you're as good as the people you play against, and they allow you to do things or make you do things much better than you normally would if the competition was less. I played against him early on, played against Kareem later on. But Bill was a complete basketball player. A lot of people think that he was just a defensive basketball player. He averaged 17 points a game, which is a great many points. He was a great rebounder and great in assists. But because he was associated with the winningest team in professional sports, the Boston Celtics, and also because I believe he was a man of color, a lot of people like to compare and make comparisons because we played the same sport and the same position. I, though, believe there was no comparisons. People should be allowed to, you know, stand on their own laurels. And I also believe that there were people out there who wanted to see maybe a separation between us for a lot of different reasons, and sort of like, you know, separate and conquer, or someone's going to have to fall here, you know, and whether it's Bill or whether it's Will.
What was your relationship with him off the court? What was it, a friendly?
Very, very close relationship. Bill Russell, to give an example, would come and play, always Boston, played Philadelphia on Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. He would come to my house for Thanksgiving dinner, eat my food, go up and sleep in my bed, then come back, you know, out on the court and beat my team. You understand?
Good friend.
Yeah, good friend. He was, you know. So, you know, he had one statement to make about me later on in his career as he left, which caused a little confusion to people, and they thought from that we were, like, really not good friends.
What did he say?
Well, what he had said was he was questioned in a tour he was doing after his last game, and they had beat us in the seventh game of NBA. I was playing for the Lakers. I had gotten hurt during the game, came out for a while, wanted to go back in. My coach didn't seem fit to put me back in. And so someone asked him, well, if Will had been playing, you guys would have probably lost. And he took exception to that. He had won 10 years already. He didn't feel as though he needed to have to hear about Wilt. And he made a statement about he would have not set out that last part of the game unless he had a broken back. And people kind of took it as, a slant, an insult toward me.
Let's take some phone calls. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, my God. Mr. Chamberlain, there's a quote
that kind of reaction
to you, and I wanted to know if it was true. There was a guy from North Carolina State, Tom Burleson, a skinny 7'4" guy. And you said, if he wants to get Wilt Chamberlain shape, he should run in place for 45 minutes and do 100 push-ups and 100 sit-ups. So that's my Will Chamberlain workout. Is that true? Did you really
say
that?
Will Chamberlain
still
does.
Do it?
Well, you know, I still do all those kind of things, but I'm afraid that's not my my quote. I mean, I believe in working out a great deal. In fact, I may have been one of the first men in sports to get involved with lifting weights and doing weight workouts way back in the 50s when it was not appreciated by most coaches or athletic people.
Second question. I'm from West Philly, but I'm from West Catholic, not Overbrook.
Mm.
You were in a championship game against West Catholic where they had four guys cover you, and you lost in overtime. Do you have any memories of that game?
You're bragging now. You're bragging.
Let's set things straight.
Because West Catholic did win that game. Had a guy named Lindsay who played very, very well, and your coach, Yulson. But, I remember that game only too well. That we came out on the short end, losing by a point or so, and West Catholic played very, very well. We got revenge, though, a couple years later, you know, and knocked them off for the city title. And I almost went to West Catholic, by the way. My second choice of high schools to go to was West Catholic. So,
what about St. Tommy Moore? Did you almost go there?
Yeah, St. Tommy Moore was third, or maybe second. Both of them, they were kind of, you know, one of those schools I thought about going to, St. Tommy Moore, which was close to my junior high school, Shoemaker, or either West Catholic, which was in my area.
Well, last observation, I get off here. What you say about sex, that's what Henry Miller said. If you write about your life and you don't write about sex, you're really not writing about your life. Take care.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. I have to pick up on something this caller just said. He got on the phone with you and he said, oh, my God, you write about this in your book, fact that people have this reaction to you.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a wonderful complimentary feeling to me that you can evoke that kind of an emotion, that kind of a statement. And I don't want people to think I'm ever callous about that. If I ever get to the point where I don't appreciate that, then I'm not living anymore.
And you don't want people to confuse you with God, right?
Yeah. It's in that book, right? It's in that book.
I want to talk a little bit about the reactions that you have had to your size. And you go to great lengths to say that people feel they can come up to you just because you're tall and say things which, if they said to someone else, could be insulting.
Yeah,
but because of your height, they feel they can do that.
Well, what about people just kind of walking up to you that don't know you and little old ladies that just stand beside you and take their hand on their head and measure and see where they come up to you? I mean, you're like, boom, I come up to its waist, you know, so on and so forth. The insensitivity, I think, is brought upon by, you know, people's astonishment about height. You know, Empire State Building, tall mountains. They're just really astonished by it, and sometimes they don't know what to say, so they kind of act stupid. And they're very insensitive, and it's really, I don't really quite understand, because if you were maybe a little heavy, a little overweight, you wouldn't ask the guy, hey, how much do you weigh, or how big is your waist? It must take a lot to fill that up. I see people say some of the things, I can't believe it, you must eat so much food, like I have to fill up my legs, you know, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the question I can understand is, well, how tall was your mother, how tall was your father? Because right away, they see you tall, so they want to know. Well, my father was 5'8 and a half. You know, tallest in his family, but he was so tall in so many other ways you can't believe it. My mother was a 5'9", 9.5".
Huh.
So nothing very imposing there, you understand? But if you saw a person who was 100 pounds overweight, would you go up to him and say, hey, how much did your father weigh? You understand? You know, no, you wouldn't get into that right there. They think of on sensitivity in other ways, but not when it comes to height.
Okay, let's take some more calls. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Hey, well, how you doing?
Just fine.
Hey, I grew up in the Philadelphia area, and you were my hero.
Thank you.
You along with Chet Walker, Hal Greer, Billy Cunningham. I mean, I followed you guys. I lived and died with you. But before, I was down there last year when they retired your number down the spectrum.
Thank you.
And that was a great event in my life. But I got to ask you this. I mean, I've been hearing all about the 20,000
people. All right, go ahead.
People. Okay, how early in life did you start?
You know, I almost hate to send that message out. And if my sisters are listening, you know, and thank God my mother and father may, I hope, you know, they may be listening too. You know, I used the age of 15 when I started. That may be high. I may have started earlier. You know what I'm saying? I was a precocious youngster in that way. But, you know, those things happen.
Well, what I thought about you before and your reputation, it's just grown 20,000 times more.
Hey, thank you.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Will.
Hi,
how are you?
I wonder if you get to the Hopkinson House much anymore.
Not very much anymore. Of course, you apparently know that I used to live there.
That goes back quite a few years.
Yeah, of course.
We met a number of times in the old 7-Eleven there.
Okay, right.
You well know.
Yeah.
The reason I called, I know West Catholic was your second choice after Overbrook.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what your reaction is to the idea of West Catholic, that wonderful planet 49th and Chestnut, just sitting idle.
Oh, okay. I think it's really a waste. You know, we have so many things like that going on, you know, that we can't turn it into something of some value. You know, like what about some vocational schools that we need? You know, I believe that there's should be more schools that will give opportunities to, let's say, athletes who want to go out there and play and hope they become pros. Give them a chance to become carpenters or, you know, plumbers, electricians, mechanics, which are really valuable jobs that, you know, when you don't have one, you know how valuable they really are, and still have a chance to equate and play in NCAA number one type of conditions.
It has a beautiful gym, and the tragedy is that it's just sitting idle and the gates are locked and it's barred to the community. Mm. You might be interested. I was involved sometime with Paul Robeson Jr. in an effort to reopen it as a Paul Robeson Vocational School.
Oh.
And the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, however, had other plans for it, but they haven't really decided or revealed what those plans are.
Well, you can see we're on the same page here a little bit.
I would hope something would develop.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you. Sure, bye-bye. When you started out playing professional basketball, I almost hate to ask this, how white was the sport? What I want to talk about is a little bit about how you think race has been dealt with in professional sports since you've been there.
Well, my hat must be taken off to professional basketball because they have treated it with the proper respect, have start to hire people only because of talent and have not looked at, you know, the color of one's skin and or minorities. It was only one maybe to a team or less when I entered the league in 1958-59. Now, as you know, it's 70% men of color and in great positions, general managers, coaches, what have you. There is even a group, I believe, in Denver that may be of color as owners. Things have changed a great deal, and basketball has helped to make a change by presenting some great athletes who've done some great things, and my hat is off to basketball.
For your sort of personal experience, though, I'm wondering even how it was to be a minority in a white sport
in
the beginning.
Well, you know, it was sort of shocking in some particular ways because at the time, you know, being from Philadelphia, and I know it's gone through some problems, and Charles Barkley has some things to say, but I never encountered any racism, and I went to cities like St. Louis, Missouri, which was still practicing segregation in restaurants, even when I was playing. And so I wasn't allowed to eat after certain games and so on and so forth. So I became somewhat angry, not militant, but I was an activist and started to really work very hard on getting some of these things changed. But playing, I had no problems ever playing among just white guys. I played with plenty of them during my high school days. I was raised in an interracial neighborhood, and it seemed quite proper and quite all right to me.
Okay, let's take some more calls. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Love your show.
Oh, good.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
The recent controversy over Charles Barkley's comments and the makeup of the Sixers, where Charlie is alleging that they don't want an all-black team, has caused a lot of discussion among sports fans and non-sports fans alike. And some of the comments that I've been encountering, which I disagree with, are people are saying that the reason that the NBA is primarily black is because black men make better athletes and they have a longer hamstring and this kind of stuff. And I think these kind of comments are blatantly racist. I think it's racist thinking. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this and if you maybe could explain why the NBA does seem to be primarily black.
Well, you know, it's pretty hard sometimes to get into talking about these things without sounding like a racist. If you're talking about horses and some of them are bred for speed, and so they're going to, you know, or distance or strength, the Clydesdale are, I mean, that's breeding. There could be some genetic things going on there. I am not an anthropologist or a doctor to be able to answer you in correctness about why certain things are. But it is apparent that certain black athletes are possess, you know, things like speed. If you watch the 100-yard dash all over the world, it's filled with black athletes being faster than almost any other group. It must be a reason for that. I address some of these reasons in my book. I talk about things like flair that they seem to have, even though Pete Maravich had as well as anybody else. Of course, he was white. But when you see Jordan and you see Larry Bird is a consummate pro who can really do it all. Mm-hmm. And Jordan does it all, too. But he does it in another way. I wish that we could talk about these kind of things without people thinking that you are a racist. No one is trying to demean any particular race, because there's only one race as far as I'm concerned, and that's the human race.
What about what Charles Barkley seems to imply, which is that an all-black team, that the owners of the 76ers don't want an all-black team, I guess feeling that it might affect ticket sales?
Well, let's suppose that he may be right about it affecting ticket sales. That's the supposition. When I came in the league, that a lot of teams felt that way very strongly. The Boston Celtics, though, fielded an all-black starting team, which is the same difference in Boston, which has sometimes been accused of being a very racist city. And they did so and did it very, very well for many, many years. You have to remember that professional sports is a business, and people are trying to run it as such, and they're trying to maybe do some things that are going to enhance their business. Maybe it's not, you know, very good business to have an all black team. I'm not really sure what the reason is. Charles Barkley is a very sensitive man, and he's speaking on something that I'm sure that he believes. I have to give him credit for wanting to speak up. But the only thing I'm bothered about here is that he's given maybe an illusion that Philadelphia is a very racist city, and in times, and this is not true. There's so many wonderful people here, and I know so many of them, and they're now being maybe sort of drugged through the mud a little bit, and that's not good.
That was Sixers basketball great Wilt Chamberlain talking with me live in studio in 1991. In just a moment, we'll be back with more Radio Times Rewind, including Wilt's take on which sport is his kryptonite and what drew him to stump for Richard Nixon in 1968. Welcome back to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Let's get back to my 1991 interview with Wilt Chamberlain. We start here talking about the grueling nature of professional sports and the injuries that pile up along the way.
What kind of injuries do you have, or have, do you live with aches and pains because of your professional basketball
career? Yeah, you know, I really do, and that's one of the residual effects of playing professional sports. A lot of people don't think of it as such, but, you know, mine are beginning to catch up with me a little bit more right now, even though I stay very active.
Like what? I mean, what do you have to do?
Like maybe in a year or two, a hip transplant.
You know, really?
Yeah, maybe, and even sooner than that, a new knee, a whole new knee joint. Those kind of things happen. I've had major surgery on elbows, on both knees, and you know, I'm active though. I play a lot of volleyball, a lot of racquetball, a lot of things, and so the body, it wasn't meant to play sports.
And a sport on a really hard floor, right?
Absolutely. And when you're weighing 300 pounds and so on and so forth, you know, it's really tough.
And yet you have had offers, I think, as recently as 2 years ago to get back into professional sports.
Which is really very complimentary coming from these people to me. And I may help to embellish those offers a little bit by flirting with the thought of coming back. But yeah. No way, brother.
Why not?
No, well, you know, I left the sport at almost 37 years of age. I was still on top in rebounding and maybe in block shots, and I broke a record percentage. My heroes, Joe Louis's and Sugar Ray Robinson's and Rocky Marciano was also one. You know, but take Lewis and Robinson. I just thought they maybe stayed around a little too long where Marciano left still undefeated. Well, I couldn't leave undefeated, but I wanted to leave having people remember me that I was still good, and I thought that was important, and going back would have put a blemish on that.
Did you ever look back?
Oh, I definitely look back and wish that, you know, I could have done some things different. But, you know, you as an athlete, you have to do what you feel at the particular time.
What would you have done differently?
Oh, well, you know, if you want to go back far enough, okay, I would have stayed an amateur a little longer, uh-huh, so I could have became a decathlete, which was my real love, track and field, and be able to participate in the Olympics. I think with some things that I was God-given, strength and speed and stamina and a certain amount of agility for a guy 7 foot tall, would lend itself very well to being a decathlete.
Would you have finished college?
You know, that's a tough subject. I have finished college in other ways. I was meant to make my living playing professional basketball, and they had stopped doing that in college for me, helping me to enhance my game. So I talked to an educator who was the chancellor of the University of Kansas, and we discussed it, and he thought and actually advised me that maybe I could forego my last year and go out into the world and sharpen my, my tools, so to speak, and someday get back to finishing your education. There's a lot of ways to become educated. I promote that. It's a great foundation. But for me, and I'm one of a very, very few, this was better.
Would you, though, and I assume other kids have come up to you and say, hey, you know, it looks like I got a good career. Would you suggest I stay in school? What would you say?
Well, that's why I'm advocating, like, you know, the vocational situation. Mm-hmm. And you got to be very, very careful about this, because most of these kids who may think that they are maybe professional material will never see the light as far as pros are concerned. So you better be careful. And education, believe me, is the way, the open doors out there in life as you become an older person. So I'm all for it. I continually, even today, study. I'm learning languages and do whatever I possibly can. But the foundation that I got from high school and college has helped me to prepare myself to do these kind of things and to write a book, you understand? And in this book I wrote myself, and I'm very, very proud of that. But it stems from that initial education.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some more calls. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Wilt. I have two questions for you.
Okay.
Number one, whatever happened to this record? By the river, beneath the shady trees.
You know
baby.
This guy?
Well, he should have sang the record, you know, for me. I don't know what happened to it, but if you have a couple of copies, save me something. You know, they're collectors. Maybe 100 years from now, we can get a lot of money for it.
But did it sell? I remember you doing that on a Dick Clark
it
show.
Sold. The record, it sold. The record sold. I think people bore it to laugh at themselves and to amuse themselves. I mean, the record was big in Boston. Can you believe that?
I do believe it.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know whether they were
Bill Russell fans,
yeah, maybe. I don't know, throwing to the Boston River or whatever, you know what I'm saying? But it was big. Got number 13 on the charts in Boston. I did the record, though, as a lark, as a joke. My sisters are very good singers, and my mother was a good singer. So when I was asked to do a record, I said, well, let me do this record and surprise them. Suppose I make, you know, on the charts, like I said, hey, you know, you guys think y'all can sing? Look at me, you understand? They just laughed at me.
I thought it was great. And the other question is, and I know in parts of your book, you were talking about who, in your opinion, were the best athletes. And I think you included yourself as being fifth, and you named a few other people. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to take a pot shot at you, but I'm just wondering this. Mm-hmm. Why were you such an incredibly poor foul shooter?
Well, that's not a pot shot, you know, and that's a really very fair question.
Well, you talk about this in your book.
Yeah, I do. You know, I'm really, you know, I was a good foul shooter in high school and a fair foul shooter in college, and I continued to get worse and worse. It was a head trip. You know, it was actually a head trip. I could make foul shots in practice, and I did so. You know, I went to a psychiatrist for 2 months, and he worked on this head trip, right? Well, after 2 months, he was a great foul shooter. I was the same, you understand? I mean, and that's just the way it was. I have no excuse for it, and there should be no excuse for it. But I did practice. It wasn't for lack of practice.
But it was mainly like a mental block, you think?
Definitely a mental block.
Yeah.
That reminds me of a story about a catcher that I was reading about who was having a hard time. I mean, he's a professional baseball player throwing the ball to the pitcher.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
right.
The kind of mental. Yeah,
very right. And you know what happens is it's like a slump. Mine was a prolonged slump that lasted my whole professional career. But it was like a slump. You know, when you get in a slump, you start doing things wrong. And you don't know what it is. But the more you think about it, the more you stay in that slump. Right.
And well, nice talking to you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
And thanks for singing.
Okay,
thanks.
I tried.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's take another one. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine.
Good. Hi, Will. How you doing?
Just fine, thank you.
Good, good. I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, up in the countryside, so I never really got a chance to see you play live. We did have a TV up there and have electricity. So I
oh, you had a TV. Good.
Did get
running
a chance
water.
To see you, but I've always thought that you were probably, without a doubt, the best basketball player ever. So
that's nice of you.
I'll let you know that. What do you, would you like to, if you're a few years younger. Would you like to play in the 92 Olympics with the rest of the guys?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that right there, because even in my first book, I advocated that professionals should be allowed to represent their country.
Correct.
And play in the Olympics, you know. But I must say now that I'm appalled at the way they chose the team. For some guy sitting in a room, maybe smoking cigars or whatever, and saying, oh, this guy, that guy, this guy. You know, there's a lot of us out there who would have liked to maybe had a chance to try out for the Olympic team. There should have been a different platform for choosing this.
And yourself included.
And myself included.
What have you tried out for the 92 Olympic team?
Well, you know, I would have tried out. You know, but you see, let me say something to you. I wanted to try out in 88 for the volleyball Olympic
right.
team, which I think I could have made. But the Volleyball Association was very strong in believing that if you're going to, like, try out for the team and you make the team, you must be available to go on these trips with your Olympic team and do all these different things, which are about 2 and 3 months of my time, which I was not willing to give. And therefore, I shouldn't accept, you know, coming out there and taking some other guy's position who was willing to give it. And that's the same thing I feel about this team.
Do you still play volleyball?
Oh, I still play a lot of volleyball, not as much as I would like to, because I've now become a working man.
Am I going to see any pro two-on-two sand?
Yeah, well, all those guys are my buddies, and I play against a lot of them, you know, when they're getting themselves in shape to go out on that tour. So, you know, I still have a chance to do that, but I don't think I'll make the tour.
So you're kind of the springboard. If they can beat you, they're good enough to go on tours.
That's about right.
What do you think of Charles Barkley as a player?
Well, you know, in my book, he is one of my favorite people. I think he embodies the spirit and the gusto that most players would like to have. And plus, he's a very talented individual. So, you know, he's just high on the list for me.
So you would have enjoyed playing with him?
Oh, boy, you bet.
Or playing against him.
You know, a lot of people criticize Charlie for what he says at times and things like that, but I'm the same type of person, you know, emotional, and when I'm really happy and things are going really well, you'll see it. When I'm peeved, you'll see that also. And he's just the same type of player, and I like to see a player that way. I thought you were very intense.
Yeah.
And I thought you were the same type of player.
Well, you're right. It's sometimes not good, though, when you're in the public life, to be as intense as we are, and we end up, as I say, saying some things. And sometimes you say some things that you would like to have taken back.
Sure.
You know, no one is writing our script. We aren't the president, you know, some senator with some great speechwriter is writing all the things. They don't say had because it sounds like you're being too whatever, you know, say be involved, you know. And always say, hey, we're coming from emotion. We may not be as educated in certain areas, and you can't take everything we say as a matter of true fact. Because maybe later on we want to take it back a little bit, but now it's down in indelible ink and is used against us.
Yeah, it's just true. It's just like if I've had a really bad day and somebody's going to approach me, I'm going to blast them.
Yeah,
but it's not going to go in ink.
Yeah, right.
You know, and sometimes I think the sportscasters and writers you know, they crowd your face after you've had a bad game, and to hold the poise.
I went after.
So you never had a bad game, but
no, I did. And you know, let me tell you something. I went after a guy who you know is writing a lot of books right now. His name is McGinnis.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? And he
Joe?
Was Joe, right? And Joe was a personal friend of mine, and he knew me very, very well. I helped him when nobody liked old Joe. You understand? And then he came to me after a game that we had lost, the seventh game that we had lost to Boston in 68, and accused me. Maybe, well, if you had practiced more fouls or something, you'd have been, you know, you could have helped, you know. And I went after him. Somebody had to hold me back. And I'm not that kind of a guy. But it was the wrong time to bring up, you know, shooting fouls to me.
Yeah.
So, that happens, you know.
Yeah, but when you scored your 100 points, if my memory serves me correct, I don't have a book in front of me, I think you were like 24 or 28 from the foul line.
28 for 32. And you know I got to remember that, brother. 28 for 32.
Was your first book fairly successful, Will?
My first book was very successful. But understood, it was written by David Shaw, who won a Pulitzer Prize last year as an investigative writer. This one was written by Wilt Chamberlain, you know, and I'm very happy that I think it's good.
Well, I didn't
even
know you had a second book out, so I'll make sure I get a copy of that because I really enjoyed your first book very tremendously.
Okay.
It was much more so than just a sport book. It talked a lot about you.
Yeah, I know you'd like to stay with us for the next 20 minutes. I got to move on.
Right.
Okay,
thank
I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Will, have yourself a very nice day, and thank you for the opportunity of talking.
Oh, sure. Thanks for calling in.
Take care.
And I should add that Will Chamberlain's book is called A View from Above. You played with the Harlem Globetrotters. Was that more fun than playing professional basketball?
Oh, I mean, Marty, absolutely. In fact, you know, I started my career with the Harlem Globetrotters. A lot of people don't realize I played for 17 years, every off season with the Harlem Globetrotters, and even after I finished, I still play some games. Hurricanes, the Harlem Globetrotters, because I love them. I mean, they want to charge me for being there because I used to laugh so much and have so much fun. You understand? Instead of paying me, they actually want to charge me. It was a great foundation for me, and it gave me something that I'm still involved in doing, is seeing the world like people can never do. I mean, it took me to places. I met two popes, and you know, and I went to every little town all over the world, from China, you know, to Africa, to, you know, Yugoslavia, wherever. It's great.
Well, I think that from the Globetrotters you get this love of game, and I sometimes feel like with professional sports, it's all, as you say, it's all business.
Oh,
I mean, it's kind of no-nonsense.
It really is, and it has evolved even more so. Because these guys are making so much money, and they're a product of millions and millions of dollars, it's even much more business today. And that's a pity, because I don't see, and I know a lot of these guys really having as much fun as we did during our era. I just saw Sonny Jurgensen. I was in Washington yesterday, and we talked about that. He was an old quarterback.
Yeah.
He said that we knew how to have more fun in our day. Which is very, very important, I think.
Well, do you think it's just the money? I mean, is that the problem?
Oh, I think so. I think it's just the root. You know, money is the root of all evil. I think money is truly the problem. You know what I'm saying? A lot of problems. If you're paying a guy, for instance, $5 million a year, you know, and he's this big investment, and all of a sudden he doesn't get along with the coach, you can't throw your investment away, so the coach has to go. You know what I'm saying? So there's a lot of things that happen just from money alone.
Who would your dream team be?
Oh, my dream team. Yeah, my dream team would have to encompass more than just, you know, five guys, because if I go to this era, I would take Larry Bird along with Elgin Baylor at forwards, and a Magic Johnson and a Jerry West and Oscar Robertson at guards, and a Bill Russell would be there at center along with myself, and a Charles Barkley maybe coming off the bench. And then if we need a center or either a guard or a forward, I could always call in Michael Jordan.
Okay. Right. As a backup safety. One of the things you do in your book is you really challenge women to be more supportive of women's sports.
Yes.
And you say you really, first of all, you love women's tennis. You like to watch that level of play.
Yeah, right.
Why do you think women's sports doesn't get quite the coverage? Is it it doesn't have the support, or we don't appreciate what happens when women compete?
Well, in most of the sports, women cannot play it as well as men. Because these sports were made for men. And it's time for some woman out there, you know, physical doctor out there, and you know, go out there and invent a sport that's for women. One that deals with, you know, flexibility, balance. You know, they deal with pain very, very well. They're very agile. And they, you know, a lot of these things that they have going for them, that you can get a sport, you know, like the beam in gymnastics.
I was going to say, yeah, sounds like you're talking about gymnastics.
Yeah, right. You're talking about what you take that beam and maybe do something around it, which gives them the edge. All the sports are talking about strength and speed and you know, and those kind of things, and gives the men the edge. But when you watch tennis, you get a chance to watch the real flow of the game. You get a chance to watch what's really happening out there. The guys, they serve the ball so hard, boom, boom, and it's over. You don't see anything. Some guy sitting next to me said, "Did you see that serve, Becker? Wow, 120 miles an hour." I said, "No, I didn't see the serve. I saw the number register up there on that scoreboard, 120 miles an hour. You don't even see it. So what are you really watching?" You know what I'm saying? I like to see what I'm watching.
You say also you can't hit a baseball. Is that right? Yeah. I don't want to overstate this here.
No, you're right. You know what I mean? You know, I used to like, you know, how you put three guys out in the field and you're supposed to hit the ball to them, you know.
Yeah.
If I throw it up, I strike my own self out. I mean, I'm really, you know.
Well, why? You don't see it? You don't see it coming?
Well, I don't know. Let's don't talk about it.
Okay. Let's take some calls instead. And my guest today at Radio Times is Wilt Chamberlain. His book, it's a second book, but the first one that he's written by himself is called A View from Above. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure talking with Wilt and yourself.
Great.
Thank you.
I have a couple of comments and a couple of questions
here.
Go ahead. One is I'd like to make a comment about a life of an athlete. As you had alluded to in your book, your many affairs, I think that a lot of things that people are missing is that being an athlete and in the public eye and a legend of sorts, a lot of things are just put in front of you. You don't really have to establish a relationship, establish a real rapport with a person. Not saying you didn't, but I'm just saying, generally speaking,
you're correct.
athletes, and having played basketball on a minute level, you know, I found that out very early on in age. Mm. I mean, in junior high school, there were women waiting for me after games.
Mm. Right.
Second thing is I had the pleasure of having a split letter from Overbrook in basketball myself. And one of the thrills is knowing that you went there previous to me and that I'm sort of following in your footsteps.
Well, thank
That's
you.
Great.
Growing up at Salford and Vine, I often saw this exotic car on, I guess that's Redfield Street, the 400 block.
Right.
All the kids would gather around, and sooner or later you would come back out, talk to us, and what have you.
Right.
It was always a pleasure seeing you going to visit your parents and speaking with us. And I must tell you that I'm not on athletes as being role models. I don't think that's a position you necessarily wanted to be in, but I can say that as I reflect back on my life, that you were a role model, and I appreciate it for it.
Oh, nice
I can only say thank you, and apparently you're from the neighborhood, man, and that's very, very nice.
I'd like to ask you to address an issue back on the life of an athlete. You mentioned, or it's noted now, 20,000 endeavors here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Somebody like Joe Namath or Jim Brown, for instance, in that circle of living, that wouldn't be too
No, they would understand that very, very well and probably could very well compete with that number.
Really? Wow.
That's something I think, you know, you hear all this ballyhoo about that, and you never really understand that unless you've been in sports.
Yeah.
That is very easy to accumulate.
Yeah, but let me say one thing, you know, here. It's for me. It was never meant to be a conquest. It was meant to be, as you said, a lot of it was thrown in front of you because maybe they were trying for a conquest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was really enjoying something. I was a lustful man, and I was really at that time enjoying something. And I'm not ashamed of it. I mean, and it was mutual consent. So why it should be controversial, I don't really know.
You say that you almost got caught up in a trap to get you into a paternity suit.
Yeah,
I mean you were a target
I was a target for. And I'm fortunate that you know during my era there was a lot of paternity suits against a lot of friends of mine. You know, and a young lady tried to do that with me. You can read about it in depth in my book, but I found out just in time, and then I had her checked out and found out that she and her boyfriend, who pretended to be her agent as she was a movie star, had set the whole thing up.
Okay, well,
can I make one quick point?
Yeah, real fast.
About racism, I find that racism in sports is probably less than racism in society, but it's much more magnified because of whatever reason it's in the public eye more. I think that, and relating this to Charles Barkley's statement, and that there is a small minority of people who probably feel the way that Barkley said they feel, but those are the people who might be in control, who are pulling the strings, the advertisers and whatnot, and not the fans. And it seems like people are getting upset with the fans, you know, being racist. It might not be the fans who he's saying are racist. He could be saying that the owners or the advertisers are racist and don't want a white team.
Okay.
Well, could you comment on that, Wilton? I'll hang up.
Thanks for your call.
I second your motion. I second your motion for sure.
Okay. Thanks for calling in. Bye-bye. Let's take some more calls. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Wilton, you almost have me feeling sorry for you. You talk about the insensitivity towards you for being tall. You talk about being taken for a villain all the time. You talk about those aches and pains.
He's having a good time. Come on now.
Yet you've wound up to be a multi-millionaire. You've got a major book out, and you say you've betted 20,000 women.
You don't feel sorry for yourself, though, do you,
no.
Will Chamberlain?
No, I'm just, you know, he may be taking it that way, but if he was listening to this great program, I said that I owe everything I have to basketball, and basketball has been very, very good to me. And we're talking about some of the residual effects, and some of the residual effects are these things that I am now doing. Mm. And, you know, the second book was a reflective thing for me, and it was very therapeutic for me to look into my soul and learn some things about myself. I'm very happy to be 7 foot tall right now, but if you were growing up as a kid, 14 years old, and people were staring and pointing at you and looking at you as a freak, you may become a little frustrated. You may have a little bit of feelings about that. So unless you are, you wouldn't know.
but Wilt, I want to hear about your soft side. Tell me about the woman that you fell in love with. Tell me about the woman that you gave your heart to. I'd really like to hear about that.
Well, we don't have enough time for that on this area right there, but there was five, not just one. See, I don't believe you can fall in love many times. I was involved very strongly in five relationships that could have ended up in wives if I had maybe didn't have a little fear and that my feet weren't exactly on the ground. You know, I'm not insensitive to those kind of or impervious to those kind of feelings. I had them. I hope to have them again, and maybe I can find the lady who will make it just a mono situation for Wilt Chamberlain.
Okay, thanks for your call. Talking about tall guys on the court, what do you think about Manute Bol?
You know, unfortunately for Manute Bol, he started his basketball career late in life, and I don't appreciate. See, I am not from the era of specialists. I like to see people be all around in their playing and what they do. Manute Bol is a specialist, and means that, you know, you do one thing well, but some other things you don't do too well. And you're only as good as your weakest link. I don't see, you know, him playing defense or blocking his shot, and then going down the other end of the court and just kind of standing there. It makes for nothing to me. And I think they've kind of like misused Manute Bol.
A player like that, is that hard to play off someone that can do one thing?
Well, it makes it easy, you know. It makes it very easy to if you're an athlete. I mean, hey, you know what he can do, and so you get ready for just that. The coach says, hey, you know, all this guy can do is rebound. So what I want you to do is block him out. So you only got one thing to worry about. When I was talking about learning to be a fighter, he was going to teach me how to fight one guy. It's easy about one guy because you can learn what he can do, but learning the whole fight game, that's a whole different story.
Okay, let's see how many more calls we can squeeze on the air here. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Oh, I call that. I wanted to ask a question about when he was going to Overbrook.
Sure, go ahead.
I was calling to ask you about. Remember the little guy I used to go around with named Gilbert?
Yeah, sure.
Oh yeah, I was telling somebody that was one of your dearest sort of friends, and he used to play baseball pretty good.
Yeah. Gilbert was a guy of not very very tall in stature, but he was also our manager of our basketball team, and I think he was something like around 3 feet 2 inches or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I told him he could play baseball pretty good.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'm up from around your old neighborhood, too.
Oh, okay. Oh, great. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for calling in.
Okay, bye-bye.
Does anyone still call you Dippy?
yeah. I had some calls on another show where some guy called and said Dippy, and the host said, what? Dippy. I said, well, that's an endearing name from days gone by.
Well, where does that come from?
Well, it comes from, actually, at that call, they called it dipping the ball into the basket at that particular time. Now they call it dunking it into the basket. So Dippy is better than Dunky, I think.
I think so. Let's take some more calls. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. I've enjoyed the show tremendously.
Good, I'm glad.
Mr. Chamberlain, you brought up Joe McGinnis before and how you wanted to punch him in the head.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about his book, The Selling of the President.
Right.
And you did figure in that in relation to the Nixon campaign in a small way. How do you feel about Nixon now?
It wasn't a small way, my man. It was a big way.
I meant the book.
Yeah,
on the book.
Oh, you're right. I still think Nixon is the one. As I write in my book, politics is a dirty business, and you know, and most mothers wouldn't be proud of their sons in politics. I think that that Richard was no different than a lot of politicians, and he got caught, and maybe he was wrong, and maybe he wasn't. I'm not really sure there, but I still like Richard Milhouse Nixon.
Okay, well, from sports to politics, thank you very much, Wilt Chamberlain.
That was my 1991 interview with the pride of Overbrook High, Wilt Chamberlain. Joining me now in studio is WHYY executive producer Kevin McCrory, who is helping me sort through the archives to make this new Radio Times Rewind series. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Marty. Good to be here.
So what did you make of Wilt Chamberlain?
I love the interview. I mean, what really stuck out to me was the interaction with the callers, right? Yeah. Those 1991 callers just loved Wilt, loved talking to him, giving them their memories, and his reactions like felt very genuine. And,
yeah.
And he really felt like he was interested in interacting with the people.
Well, I think this being his hometown, there was this connection, if I can use that word, with the people calling in that knew him, knew what he went to Overbrook, all those things that made him, I think, feel really comfortable. My memory, and this is sort of obvious, is how tall he was.
Right.
7-1. Right. And I remember him standing up, and he just kind of kept going up and up and up.
And do you remember how that kind of came together? Were you like trying to get him and book him? Was that tough? Do you remember at all?
You know, this was, 1991, so it was a long time ago. He had a book.
Yeah.
Obviously on a book tour, because he was in studio, which I always love. And I'm sure they had put Philly on his stop because of all the things that he had done and the fact that he lived here. So I assume it was part of a junket that he was on, going from station to station, talking about himself.
Right. Okay. But sports weren't like necessarily your thing.
No. I mean, I know enough about sports to know that Wilt Chamberlain was a big deal, you know, so we were very excited to have him on the show. But, you know, I had to do my homework just to make sure I understood that 100-point game. But mostly I was interested in him as a person, you know, not the plays so much, or even some of the sports rivalries. It was more, who is this guy?
Right. And of course, in that book, he had put that factoid about his sexual adventures
he
in
did.
There.
He
and
did.
That came up early in the interview.
Yeah,
were you a little nervous talking about that, or
not so much? I mean, he was very generous, but I think he could tell a little prickly, not terribly prickly, but just a little bit. So, but once you sign on to an interview, it's your job to ask the questions. So I felt like you put it out there. Let's figure it out.
And your question to him was something along the lines of like, why write about that? And his answer was something along the lines of like, well, your sex life is part of your life, so you got to put it in the book.
There you go. And it was something like 20,000 sexual encounters. So again, do the math.
And I guess when you listened back recently to this, anything else that jumped out to you?
Well, I had forgotten that he was a big fan of Richard Nixon. So that was something that was a bit of a surprise to me. He wore number 13, as he talked about, this idea of being a villain. I thought that was really interesting. But there you are with a number 13 on your back.
It was
a thrill. I mean, how often do you get to interview someone in person?
Yeah.
Who's of that kind of stature and celebrity as Wilt Chamberlain.
Was there any questions when you were listening back, you're like, oh, I wish I asked that?
Not so much. Again, I mean, maybe if I were a sportier girl, I would have known to ask something. But again, I just want to know who this guy was. And I thought it was interesting, too. I mean, it's amazing to be an adult 7'1", but I think in like fourth grade, he was 6 feet tall. So the kind of awkwardness that he must have felt as a kid growing up before he became a famous basketball player.
I guess something that struck me a little bit was, thinking back on it, he was 55 years old when you recorded that interview.
Yeah.
And he dies about 7 years later.
Yeah, 1999 he died.
I guess, I don't know. Do you think about that when you listen back to old episodes? Just like, that there was that person in a time and place, and you've been that age, and you've been younger, and you've been older, and like, how do you reflect on that?
Well, as an older person myself now, I mean, older than Wilt was then, that kind of comes with age, where you do feel your mortality, and then people either that you know, or in this case, people that you've interviewed have died. You know, it's sobering, but it also focuses you on what was their life like when they lived.
Yeah.
Who were they? Who did they become?
Such a cool snapshot of not only his life, but your life.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a really fun interview. Radio Times Rewind is a WHYY special series planned for the next 2 months on Sunday evenings. Kevin McCrory and I are the executive producers of the show. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. Next Sunday, my 1994 interview with Hollywood star and feminist icon, Lauren Bacall.
I think people have actually confused whatever I am in life with the characters that I've played.